EU står for videnskab. Gør du? Dette afsnit er produceret i samarbejde med Europakommissionens afdeling for forskning og innovation. EU's forskning og innovationsprogram støtter danske forskere i arbejdet med at forstå sygdomme, som for eksempel Parkinson, og finde nye behandlingsmetoder. Udforsk flere banebrydende EU-støttede forskningsprojekter via hashtag Science4EU. Og læs mere på researchandinnovation.ec.europe.eu. Hej og velkommen til Hvad så forklarer alt. Mit navn det er Christian Fuglendorf. I dagens afsnit er jeg så heldig, at jeg har fået assistentprofessor Estella Newcomb på besøg. Vi skal nemlig snakke om Parkinson og den danske forskning, der bliver lavet på området, som er støttet af EU og som ligesom prøver at forstå, hvad de her såkaldte uordnede proteiner, eller på engelsk, disordered proteins, er for nogen. Og hvorfor de spiller sådan en væsentlig rolle i forhold til vores forståelse af en hjernesygdom som Parkinson. Men lad os sige goddag til Estella.
So I was an assistant professor at the University of Copenhagen for 4.5 years. Now I work at Novo Nordisk. And yeah, I worked on proteins, so sort of very small little things in your brain that can cause neurodegenerative diseases.
And it's only the proteins that is the reason why we get a disease like Parkinson's?
Well, I think like when you think about biology, proteins are like the thing that is actually doing a function. So most diseases are caused by some kind of protein. The particular kind of protein that causes Parkinson's disease is called an intrinsically disordered protein, which means that it has no proper structure.
So it's like they're not folded, they're scrambled.
Yeah, so normally... Well, historically, people always thought that proteins had to be folded, but I think within the last 30, 40 years, people have discovered that some proteins actually don't do that at all. And often these proteins are associated with diseases.
Your brain cells are constantly folding proteins into precise shapes. But when this process goes wrong, misfolded proteins spread from cell to cell like an infection.
Today we'll talk a bit about the disease Parkinson.
Parkinson's disease is a sort of a motor deficit disease, neurodegenerative disease.
What did you say, motor?
Motor, sorry, it's my Australian accent.
Oh, okay.
deficit. Okay. So people with Parkinson's often display symptoms that are like tremors, or they become very rigid and are not able to move in a normal way.
Okay.
And this is the hallmark, I guess, of Parkinson's disease compared to, say, like Alzheimer's and other diseases that involve neurodegeneration.
So when you see someone like Michael J. Fox...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm alive. It's getting harder. It's getting tougher. Every day you suffer.
When you see him, like, in the beginning and he's just shaking his hand, it has nothing to do with his muscles and anything. It signals.
Yes, exactly. So the neuronal death that happens with patients who have Parkinson's disease occurs in the midbrain. So these neurons start to die, and then your brain can't really control your body in the normal way, unfortunately.
But we have known about Parkinson for like over 200 years.
Yeah.
Why don't we just have a cure?
The problem with a lot of neurodegenerative diseases are that they're sporadic, meaning that they don't have a genetic cause. So in patients who have Parkinson's disease, it can just happen. It doesn't have to be passed down in your family. And that's then very hard for us to predict who's going to get it.
So if my dad had Parkinson, then my chance of getting Parkinson as his son is not bigger?
It's not really higher than the general public, no.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of work has been done, of course, and trying to find out like which proteins are involved, but there's still a big gap in the knowledge of like, okay, we know that protein goes wrong a little bit, but why?
So how long have we known that it's because of the proteins?
Well, alpha-synuclein is the protein that's mostly associated with Parkinson's disease. It starts to form these sort of aggregates within a cell. So a big clump of protein, instead of going off and doing its normal function, it all just kind of clumps together. And people hypothesize that that's toxic. They hypothesize that that's like a trash bin for the protein. This seems to target cells in the midbrain that are responsible for dopaminergic like function. So
try to explain what is dopamine
is often associated with like one of those happy hormones.
Okay.
You think people, I don't have any dopamine. It sort of means that someone's depressed, I guess. But actually, it also controls your motor function. So your ability to move your legs and arms at will.
Yeah,
and when those cells start to die, that's when people start to exhibit the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. But again, it's really hard for us to actually pinpoint why does it start to clump together and why does it start to become toxic.
Parkinson's disease is about as bad as it gets. The neurodegenerative disease takes away your control over your own body. It's so devastating that one of the only ways it can get worse is by affecting more people.
So how many people are affected of Parkinson disease in Denmark?
Yeah, in Denmark, it's 11 to 12,000 people, which works out to be like 200 per 100,000 people.
Okay.
I think in wider Europe, it's about double that amount and ends up costing like tens of billions of euros every year.
What about female and male?
Usually, I'm not 100% sure with Parkinson's disease, but usually with neurodegenerative diseases, women have a higher prevalence.
Yeah.
And we're not really sure why.
Okay. Can you like try to explain to me the disorder protein so I understand it? And you have to know, my academic accomplishment is high school.
Yeah, I think we can do it. So if you think about the ordered proteins, which are kind of like a circular staircase or folded over in sheets, if you think about a disordered protein, if you have like a pot of boiling water, you put some pasta in there, and then the pasta starts to get cooked and it's like bubbling away inside there, and then you have your like loose spaghetti now. It's cooked and it's bubbling away there. It's never forming one structure. It's very dynamic. It's moving around a lot, but it never really sort of comes together in sort of one firm structure ever again. And that's what we think of when we think of these disordered proteins. So like a cooking spaghetti.
So what is the problem with them? Yeah, we know they have like a more chaos structure. So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is like often if you have a structured protein, some people don't like this analogy, but basically if you're trying to find a protein that will interact with your problematic disease protein, then it's like a key and a lock.
Yeah.
So you're able to use the structure of that protein to find something that will really strongly interact with it and come together in a perfect
way. Glue with it.
Exactly, yeah. But when you have this protein that never really forms any structure, it's moving around a lot, it's very hard then to find another protein that can actually then attach to it and use it as a treatment. So that's part of the reason why it's been so difficult to actually treat these. And in the paper that we put out, it was that you could target these disordered proteins using a mirror image of an interacting partner.
Yeah, yeah.
So they do still interact with some other proteins, but by having it as a mirror image, it means that it's only really going to interact with that protein, and it's also not going to get broken down by the body so fast. So it actually has more chance of working, rather than like if you put a protein into your body, if I just ate some protein, my body's going to break it down. Because that's what you want it to do. We're harvesting those amino acids, and that's why you know, when you go to the gym, you're eating more protein, you're giving your body more fuel. If you're using protein as a drug, your body can still break that down, and that's normally really good. I guess you don't want, you know, foreign proteins in there, but in some cases you don't want that because you want to be able to target something with a drug that's also a protein.
So now you are doing research in Copenhagen University. Mm-hmm. Is it nice there?
Yeah, it's great.
The people are nice?
Yeah, very nice.
Okay, okay. Are Danes like Australian people? Are we a lot different?
I mean, we have very similar drinking culture, so that helped with the integration. I think it's actually really nice to work with Danes. They have a very similar kind of affect, I guess, as Australians.
But why come to Copenhagen? You're a bigger country. You have probably more money.
I mean, actually, like percentage-wise, the amount of money that Australia invests in science is much lower than Denmark. Plus, here you have access to things like, you know, the Novo Nordisk Foundation, Lundbeck Foundation. You have all of these different initiatives set up for people to apply for funding, plus the EU. It's just a lot better to be able to work here funding-wise, I think, than Australia, unfortunately.
Why did you choose to go into the science of protein and like Parkinson's disease? Why did you go that way?
Well, I was always really interested in neuroscience. I thought, like, this is, you know, one of the final frontiers of, like, understanding how the body works. It's like this black box inside your head and no one really knows what's going on. But also my dad got diagnosed with Parkinson's, actually. So that kind of pushed me a little bit in that direction as well. I think I just got quite frustrated that, as you say, you know, these diseases have been known for so long and we don't know what causes them. And so I really wanted to get into, like, the basic research and find out exactly, like, what's actually going wrong here and can we find different ways to treat it, I guess.
I have a feeling that like Parkinson and Alzheimer and those, like, we are getting older than we used to. Is this like an age thing?
Yeah. You definitely see the prevalence increasing as people get older. And their sort of the refurbishment, I guess you could say, of the brain becomes worse. So events that could have been cleared up during your youth are not able to be cleared up.
So like the garbage cells that goes around, oh, you're destroyed, I will take you.
Yep.
They just... And when we get older, just let it stay.
Basically, okay. they get lazy. Yeah.
So because you have a dad who has been diagnosed with Parkinson, you know, I guess, how we treat it today.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do now?
A lot of the treatment revolves around trying to stop the dopaminergic neurons from dying. And this means that it basically provides dopamine so that these cells can continue to signal more functionally.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's generally like the treatment that people get. I think there are also some other more modern treatments, but that's the one that I remember the most. So.
But how can the science you're doing now change that way of treatment?
So the treatment itself technically wouldn't change. The science that I do is more about understanding the disease.
Okay.
So I'm a big sort of fan, I guess, of understanding something before you try to treat it.
I
think that's also part of what's gone wrong with a lot of the neurodegenerative diseases, where people are just like, oh, let's try this drug and it shows very minor improvements and then that's like the best that we've got, while we still don't understand what's actually going wrong.
So you want to understand how the disease works.
Exactly, yeah.
And when you look at it, you get more questions.
Yes. But you get further. Every time you find something, you are pushing the sort of limits of human knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important. And if I don't find the cause of the disease, maybe my research is something that someone else will build upon. And I think that's also one of the beautiful things about doing scientific research, but yeah.
You stand on shoulders of giants.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And then maybe someone will stand on my small shoulders.
At some point.
Yeah.
How exactly do you do it?
How do we study the proteins?
Yeah,
so we have these big magnets.
Yeah.
And they're at the university. And you basically, it's kind of like an MRI, but for a really small tube. And you put it in there and then you're actually getting this sort of topographical map of what a protein looks like. And then you basically have to go through and figure out which of those peaks actually corresponds to an amino acid. And then you try to find the structure.
So you don't see the physical protein, you see a digital?
Yeah, what? It's kind of like the footprint of the protein. So you get this sort of footprint in the sand, and then from that you have to find out what the foot looks like, basically.
Oh. If I saw a footprint, that could be a foot, like we know, but I can't see how high it is.
No.
How do you just guess?
It's maths. Okay. A lot of maths involved, okay. Yeah. So, no, you don't just guess. You eventually do get like a 3D shape based on the work that we're doing and the type of molecules that we're looking at with these magnets. But that's basically what we're working with, yeah.
Is a protein alive?
No, it's not alive.
So it's just...
No, but it does come from living things.
Okay.
It's a chain of amino acids. So your DNA is not alive, your protein is not alive, but when you put it all together, it is alive.
So, oh, okay. So it's when they collaborate.
Yeah, yeah.
It's live.
Yeah, it's a big complicated mess of protein and DNA and lipids. That's what we are.
But a bacteria is alive.
A bacteria is alive, yeah.
Is there proteins inside a bacteria?
There sure are, yes.
Oh, so they're a lot smaller than even that?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, they're very small. Smaller than DNA even.
So an atom is a lot smaller?
Yeah.
Do you know how many protein, how many atoms it's like made of?
Yes, we do know that, yeah.
You do?
Yeah. So each amino acid is made up of a carbon chain, basically.
Yeah.
With a carboxylic acid and an amine group. And then it just like makes this long chain. So we do know the chemical structure of the proteins.
Okay.
Yeah.
But is it made like of 1,000 atoms, or is it made of 2 atoms? Or is it...
It's definitely made of, well, it depends how big the protein is, I suppose, but definitely more than two. No, each amino acid is what I think at least like 5 atoms.
But you can see a protein in a microscope.
It depends how big it is, but usually, no, the proteins that we're working with, no, you can't see them because they also don't form a structure, right? So you really have to get this kind of like...
Look at this goo.
Yeah, like it's a liquid basically. And then, yeah, some proteins are big enough that you can see them with a very, very fancy microscope. But the ones that we work are not, unfortunately.
So if we jump in, like I have a small spaceship, let's go into the body, put a helmet on. How do you think it looks like?
If you go down to the cellular level, then you're like sort of weaving in between a lot of different cell types, but a lot of neurons in there, right? Which are these sort of cells which have the, you know, cell body, but then they have this long projection so that they are going and connecting with another cell. And then they transmit their sort of signal through electric pulses.
Yeah.
So I kind of think of it as like this big, almost like a circuit board.
Yeah.
Inside there, and a lot of different electrical pulses going around. You also have these cleaning up cells that are moving around, taking up any rubbish or things that don't make sense to be there.
And if I should, then when we're down here, how do you see the protein?
If you then went down to the protein size, you would just see, how can I describe this in a way that makes sense?
How do you see it in your head? You don't see, do you think, just think numbers? And
No. I mean, when I think of it, I just think of this really big crowded space.
Okay.
Like there's just, you can't move through it almost because it's just packed full of different proteins. And I don't think that inside the cell there is actually very much room for you to really move around.
No, okay.
Yet somehow things move to the places that they need to go.
It would look like in the corner and you haven't cleaned a lot, it would look like one of those...
Yeah, like one of those little lint balls.
No one knows what it is.
They're just there. Yeah. I think a nice like analogy is also kind of like an egg, you know, inside an egg.
Yeah.
You have like all of this, the egg white, I guess, is kind of like filling up that space.
Yeah.
And there's not really the ability, like if you were really microscopic to move through, quite hard because of the consistency, I suppose. And I kind of think of it a little bit like that.
The most common treatment for Parkinson's involves an attempt to restore depleted dopamine levels in the basal ganglia. So it's not a cure for the disease, and other treatments are still being explored.
Mm. do you think we'll see new ways of, I would say, attacking Parkinson in the near future?
At this stage, I think the most progress that we see is actually with stem cells. And they've actually seen very nice results from those studies where they were able to put stem cells back into Parkinson's disease patient brains.
So that's the other way. Instead of giving dopamine, you change the cell?
You basically, so those cells that have died, the dopaminergic neurons, you're trying to replace them.
Okay.
And you can use stem cells to do so. So far, it's looking promising, but again, like, these are pretty early days for that as well. So
yeah, okay.
A lot of work still to go.
Do you think in your lifetime we will get rid of Parkinson?
I think that's possible.
Okay.
Yeah, I do think that's possible, that a lot of these diseases, we will find ways around them. I think if you look at how research has progressed over the last, like, several decades, it's sort of this exponential rate where, you know, a few decades ago, we were just looking down the microscope and not really being able to see what's actually going on. And now we have all these new tools. And I don't know, I always used to tease my professors by saying that they did all of the easy science and now all the hard science is left. So, of course, there's still...
You're right. I agree.
So, of course, there's still a lot of hard stuff to do, but the tools get better.
Really? That's so right, because people always talk about, like, oh, the ancient Greece, they found, but they took the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, exactly. They found the easy stuff. And now we have to do all of the really, like, difficult stuff. But yeah, the tools get better, and maybe we are, and we're, of course, smarter for all of their research.
So. Yeah, but still, I know how you can build a triangle. Who cares?
Okay, yeah. Easy.
That's easy. Is this expensive research?
Yeah. I mean, all research is expensive, but...
Because you get the buck as scientists.
Not exactly.
So,
but it's more just like the equipment that we use is very expensive. I think to run these instruments, it's quite a lot of money.
Okay. The thing is... When like a union like EU is like funding stuff like this, do we need that? I mean, we have Novo Lundbeck. Why they are going to make the bucks on it anyway? So why should Europeans? Why should our tax money go for that kind of research?
Why should it go there? I think. Actually, it attracts a lot of scientists from overseas. Like, without the EU funding, I probably wouldn't be here because I don't, you know, when I was in Australia, I didn't know about the Novo Nordisk Foundation or anything like this. But since moving here and, you know, the EU was like a really big funder of overseas scientists because they actually run a program that gives you relocation money and this kind of thing. So it means that it's much easier to move as a scientist if you're able to acquire a grant through the EU, for example.
So how long do you stay in Denmark working on this?
Well, I've been here for 5-ish years now. And
you haven't learned Danish. Can you say anything in Danish?
Ja, hello, Stella.
Hi, Stella.
Ja, boy, Nordvest. No, Nordvest? I shouldn't say that. But I should say where
Nordvest?
I live. Yeah.
Then you should talk about the salary thing, because I'm kidding.
It's not that bad.
No, it's great. It's great.
No, I mean, I can speak basic Danish, but it's
do you
I
understand?
Was busy. I was busy doing the research.
Yeah. Do you go back often?
I try and go back like once a year.
Okay.
Since COVID's over, at least, yeah.
I really want to go there. I think it's really long way. Yes.
Yeah, it sure is.
We go to Thailand and go. I went to the States a couple of times, and I think that's long.
I don't know. I think Australians just are very good travelers because we just get used to traveling so far. It's like
course.
A 24-hour flight, I think, from here to Australia. That's, so it's just like.
Do you watch cricket or rugby?
I don't watch either
don't.
Of them. I'm a tennis person,
tennis?
And that's international.
Yeah. We like handballed.
Yes, I have found that.
And we're the only one in the world who likes it.
Yeah, it seems like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. It's a good way of becoming world champions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Just be the only one playing it.
Yeah, well, we play Australian rules football, and yeah. I guess technically that makes us always the world champions.
And we have learned it from the Americans.
Yeah, they have, it's smart.
Estela, thank you very much that I was allowed to use some of your time.
Yeah, thank you.
To tell about this. And then I will go.
Yeah.
Så vil jeg skifte til dansk. You understand that?
Yeah, so okay. We change to Danish.
Yeah. EU står for videnskab. Gør du? EU støtter videnskab, forskning og innovation i hele Europa. Også her i Danmark. Og det er en del af grunden til, vi kommer tættere på at forstå Parkinson og den fascinerende verden af forstyrrede proteiner.